Welcome to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Marty's got the day off today. Get-togethers over the holidays can sometimes feel more like an endurance test than a time of joyous celebration, as loved ones bring differing political ideals or relationship stresses to the table. The holidays are upon us, Thanksgiving, of course, the day after tomorrow. So this hour, we ask, what's the best way to navigate conversational landmines and foster a sense of goodwill and relationship, even if relatives and friends remain on opposite sides of the divide? Jason Jay is co-author of Breaking Through Gridlock, The Power of Conversation in a Polarized World. He's also senior lecturer at the MIT Sloan School of Management, and he's with us today for the entire hour. Hi, Jason.
Hi there. Thanks for having me.
Sure. Before we get going, here's how to get in touch if our listeners would like to join the conversation. 888-477-9499 is the number to call. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or send an email to radiotimes@whyy.org. So Jason, how's your Thanksgiving shaping up? Are you home or with friends or with relatives? What are you doing?
We're going to be home. We're hosting. We've got 11 adults and 3 kids. Looking forward to a full house. And I always love this holiday season.
Well, you know, most of us try to anyway. And we don't need to get too personal here. But I mean, are there conversational issues that perhaps you might need to deal with on Thursday yourself?
You know, it's a good question. We've got some new people coming over that we haven't spent too much time with, and so we don't know, you know, where those conversations could lead. I think the reality, however, is that, you know, we live in Newton, Massachusetts, in a pretty liberal bubble up here in the Northeast, and many of the conversations sort of stay insulated as a result of that. You know, when I'm spending time with my more extended family in other parts of the country, obviously that can change, or even across the political spectrum. I think the holiday times are, you know, it's moments when people are coming together who, you know, have some connection with each other, but, you know, but may find themselves in different parts of this very lively, let's say, and polarized political landscape that we're living in.
All right. Well, let's begin with politics then. Of course, post-midterms, we're still really polarized in this country. Say you're with family around the table and you just can't stomach the person who's sitting in front of you, their political views, their choice of candidates, say. Mm-hmm. They're looking at you, you're looking at them. Where do you even begin the conversation?
So I think that there's a few steps that you want to think about. You know, I think you want to prepare yourself for that conversation really well. You want to really connect with the other person before you even get into sharing your views or trying to elicit or draw out their views. You know, I think the preparation aspect of this is something that we often neglect. In our book, Breaking Through Gridlock, we have a chapter where we call Know What You Bring. And it's about, you know, kind of the metaphor is that, you know, you're carrying things into this conversation, and sort of being conscious and reflective about what you're bringing to the conversation is really key. One aspect of that is, you know, what are your goals? What do you really want to try to accomplish? The tendency is to, I think, want to try to convince the other person of your point of view. Oftentimes, a goal that we have that's unconscious that we don't recognize is our desire to sort of score points with our side while we confront the other side. You know, we're used to getting a lot of likes on our Facebook feeds and Twitter comments for things that sort of rile up our political coalition or tribe. And I think we can certainly fall prey to that in a family dinner conversation, especially if you have maybe a couple people on different, you know, sides of the line. So getting really clear about what your real goals are, what your real intentions are, and then noticing that you might have these other intentions or goals that you might not own up to, that are about, you know, being right, being certain about your perspective, scoring points with your side, and just ask yourself, is that really what I want to be doing here? Is this really the forum for that? Is the Thanksgiving dinner table the best place for that? Or is there some other context where we could be doing that? So I think that's a first thing, is really kind of preparing yourself and noticing what way of being and how are you coming into that conversation? Because if you come in really hot and you're in there to win and you're in there to win points with your side, it's probably not going to go very well.
So should we walk into the room then thinking about the end of the day and how we want to walk out of it and how we want to feel about the other people that are there?
I think that's useful. Yeah, I think that's useful. And, you know, it's funny. I think this whole question of Thanksgiving conversations is, it's so fraught because on the one hand, we don't, so the second step that I was going to say is connect and just really connect with a person based on what you share before you get into where you disagree.
And so that's where doing your homework comes in.
Doing your homework comes in, but also just being together. I mean, the tricky part about this Thanksgiving context or this holiday context is that you might not see people very often. You might only see them in these types of contexts. And so, you know, I think if in order to be able to make progress on a social or environmental or political issue, there has to be some background of relatedness. You have to feel connected to the person based on, you know, your shared experience, your shared love of a sports team or of a grandparent or you know, the food around the table. And sometimes it may make sense to let the Thanksgiving and interaction be the chance to build that relatedness, to build that shared experience, to build what you share, what you both enjoy. And then that can be the foundation for a later conversation where you start getting into where you differ. It could even be, if you know you're not going to see the person again for a long time and this is your one chance, maybe you do it a little bit later in the evening after you've shared that meal and made that connection with each other. I also think it's really important to think about how is a group conversation different from a one-on-one conversation? Because pulling someone aside and really having a dialogue with them can often be very different from being in a large group, again, where there is spectators in the conversation and people that you may or may not be trying to score points with. Sure. So just being really deliberate about that forum and what you're trying to do in each step of the evening or the context, I think, is really important.
Go in having a game plan. Well, yeah. We're already getting some comments here to Radio Times. Let's get to a tweet from Amanda who says, "Our family has learned to avoid politics entirely. Most are Trump supporters. Two of us are liberal. I leave the room when my dad or uncle just can't help themselves in making a political comment." You know, is that the way to go, to just kind of say, well, let's talk about what we share,
yes.
You know, and we like food, we like sports, and just not go there for the sake of family unity?
Well, it depends on, what you're really trying to accomplish. What do you want to have happen? You know, there are some times where these issues are very, you know, they're very personal to us. You know, maybe the issue is around gay marriage or around immigration or around race, and that's something that you personally care about because you have close friends or loved ones that you want to be welcomed into your family circle, and it's not an abstract political issue. It's a real way in which that becomes very personal. So you may have a very real reason where sort of biting your tongue and not speaking up doesn't let you achieve your goals. Or if, let's say that you are devoting your career to working on climate action and having the other people in your family not even be able to talk to you, or you feel like you can't even talk to them about what you're most passionate about, what you're devoting your career and life to, isn't what you want. It's not the family that you want to be in.
But you're there anyway.
around
the holiday table.
Like,
yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And so in those situations, you know, keeping the peace and sort of biting your tongue may not make sense at all. In other situations, if it's pretty removed from the sort of being together as a family, you know, it's you know, you have to really ask yourself, is it worth it? You know, maybe right before the midterm elections, it would be worth shaking the boat because maybe you think you can get someone to vote a different way on a ballot initiative or an election. But where we are right now, which is sort of right after an election, it's a different thing. Again, it's about what do you want to achieve, and I think it's important to ask yourself the question: what do I want to achieve in terms of the relationship? and what do I want to achieve on the issue?
Let me reintroduce you, Jason. Jason Jay is co-author of Breaking Through Gridlock, The Power of Conversation in a Polarized World, co-written with Gabriel Grant. All right, so say we do decide that we need to go there on a difficult issue with somebody who we haven't seen for a while. You say in polarized conversations, vulnerability can be powerful. Drop the weapons. So explain that, and how do you go about that?
Yeah. I think that one of the things that it's really important is when you're stating what you care about or what you, sort of your side of the issue, to really share your experience, your personal stories, the places where you have personally run into these issues and how they came to have meaning for you. And when you're talking about this, ultimately, politics is all about what is the society that we want to create. And therefore, it's about our what we value and what we envision for the future. And often we don't share that. We don't share what we really care about. We don't share what we really want to see happen and what would be really meaningful for us to see happen because that feels vulnerable. It's easier to sort of parrot the talking points from your team in the fight, or to criticize another, a political candidate, or to criticize another person. But to really expose, look, these are the ways I came to my point of view. These are the experiences that I had. And this is what I really want. This is really what I would value and would be inspired to see happen in our community and our society. That requires a certain amount of self-disclosure and vulnerability. And I think, but it's really, really important because then it really is a conversation between two people. And what it invites is, you know, you, what naturally follows from that is asking the other person about their experience. How are things going for them economically? What changes are they seeing in their community and how do they feel about them? What are their hopes for their children, for their grandchildren, for the other children in the community? And really get at that level where it's about what is our experience and our perspective, what are our wants and our values, and then that is a completely different ground for talking about these things than sparring talking points.
We're up against
that you're parroting from other people.
We're up against a break, but at what point do you simply say, okay, it's time to agree to disagree? If you haven't convinced the other person of say your side of things.
Yeah, I think you have to feel that in yourself. I think if you are, and I think first of all, you have to feel that in yourself. You have to feel that in the other person. You have to feel that in the people that surround you. There's a certain level of discomfort where in talking about these issues, but you have to kind of feel the temperature. If the temperature is getting too hot and you look at the other people around you, is everybody getting really uncomfortable, wanting it to end?
I'm going to have to stop you there for just a second.
Attention.
Jason Jay is a author of Breaking Through Gridlock. We're talking about tackling thorny issues over the holidays. Stay with us. More of Radio Time straight ahead. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in today for Marty Moskowain. Our guest for the whole hour here is Jason Jay, co-author of Breaking Through Gridlock, The Power of Conversation in a Polarized World. And we're kind of looking ahead to the holidays and the folks we might encounter, relatives, friends, people who might differ from us and in politics or social issues, and how to talk through tough thorny issues. The number to call is 888-477-9499. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times or send an email along to radiotimes@whyy.org. And Jason, we've got a tweet from Alicia who says, to the person who said they leave the room when Trump comes up, keeping the peace for the sake of family unity is less risky than speaking out against racism, white supremacy, and patriarchy. We all need to hold our families accountable. So, so what are your thoughts? Because people, people feel passionately, especially about political issues. And you know, they might feel very differently than approaching somebody who believes differently than we do politically in a conversation, and approaching that conversation with humility.
Yes.
Or go ahead.
We're in a moment of incredible cultural change. I mean, we are confronting we're confronting racial injustice in a way that we haven't in the past. We're confronting sexual harassment, discrimination, and assault in ways that we haven't in the past. We are grappling with inequality in ways that we haven't in the past. We are, and all of these things are threatening. They're threatening the existing order, and they are making us all question where we stand, whether we have been right or wrong in the past, whether we are being right or wrong now, and where we're going. And, you know, I think there are ways of confronting these issues where we just, again, start with questions, invite people to share what are their experiences, what are they seeing happen to them, to their coworkers, in their neighborhoods, in the community, and what are their thoughts about it, what are their feelings about it, and give people a chance to express all of that. And then take the space to share what we see and what we are thinking and what we are feeling about what's going on, and then ultimately what we want. And I think that there's a way of confronting these issues while also kind of taking responsibility for our own reactions to them and saying, I see this, I think this, I feel that, and I want things to be different. And then you can, and then it invites other people to do that same taking of responsibility. Because part of what creates the polarization is where I blame the other side and I declare them to be, you know, racist or homophobic, and declare me to be, you know, against the rule of law or whatever it is, and or to be a climate alarmist. And again, just really taking responsibility for how we see the world is, I think, a way to raise those issues. But I agree. I do think we can't avoid it. We're in a moment of change. We're in a moment of polarization, and it's going to take muddling through and all of us raising these questions in any context that we have the opportunity.
It sounds like it involves a lot of patience if you're going to go in and not try to, you know, be hot going into the conversation, be a little bit of, show a little vulnerability. Is patience a requisite for success here? You say you're not a patient person. I've read that.
I am a patient person in the sense that I'm a patient with people, and I try to hear out different people's point of views that are different. But I am impatient when it comes to trying to take that conversation forward into trying to come up with solutions, trying to move forward as a society in ways that recognize and acknowledge different people's values. I do think there is an aspect of this which is mindfulness, and just being able to take a deep breath and recognize when things are getting hot, recognize it when your own way of being has become something that you're not in control of anymore. And one of the things that we do in our workshops, there's the book Breaking Through Gridlock, and then we do a lot of workshops. In fact, I'm teaming up with an organization in Philadelphia called the Civic Series to do some workshops in Philadelphia later this year. One of the things we do is we literally ask people to close their eyes and take deep breaths and visualize the conversation going well. Visualize that you're walking out of the end of the evening and you have achieved your goals in terms of the strengthening the relationship, and you've achieved your goals in terms of moving forward on the issue that you care about, raising it, you know, maybe changing the other, maybe coming to a new perspective or having the other person accept your perspective, whatever that is. Just visualize it going well, and you don't have to know exactly how it went well. You just imagine walking out and the relationship is stronger and you've made progress on the issue.
And this can be a valuable tool, just taking the time
to do
a visualization.
Super valuable, because what happens,
visualization. Mm-hmm.
Yep. Because what happens is that you when you visualize that, what you notice is that there's a way of being that arises in your body and your mind, which is often it's sort of generous, it's open, it's content, it's relaxed, it's curious. And if you can show up from the beginning with that way of being and you can sort of hold on to that, then it will get you through the bumpy parts of the conversation. Whereas if you come in implicitly visualizing that the whole thing is going to be really bad and really escalated, you're going to come in with a way of being that's defensive and frustrated and ready to attack. And that's going to be a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Let's get to the phone. Go ahead. I'm sorry, Jason.
Sorry, go ahead.
Oh, no, I didn't mean to jump in. I'm sorry.
That's fine.
We've got some telephone calls coming in. I can see that one call is from Philadelphia. Can't quite make out the name on the screen, so let's get to that call. And welcome to Radio Times.
Great.
Hi, this is Jackie from Philadelphia.
Hi, Jackie.
Thank you for having me on. I just wanted to say that I think, kind of picking up on what the other tweet also mentioned, the issue, I think, was saying that we need to figure out, you know, what's worth it to us in the conversation and bringing it up. While it is important not to approach people with hostility, because you're right, that's kind of productive for a lot of our friends, for my, you know, Black friends, my queer friends and trans friends, hearing people talk about how we are thinking of, you know, whether or not to confront our family on something like that at the dinner table really sounds like we are choosing a calm and peaceful dinner over standing up for their personhood. And I really do think that that is, in the end, what it comes down to. And it's not really a choice that we should be entitled to make.
Hmm. Thank you for the call to Radio Times, Jackie. Jason, you're not necessarily saying avoid the difficult conversations.
No. I'm just saying be deliberate about where and when you engage in difficult conversations and what you're trying to achieve in terms of the relationship and the issue. We throw ourselves into these with too little intentionality. I think if there's one message that's it, is just prepare. And I agree with the caller there that sometimes these issues are abstract and they're about, federal versus state control of, you know, education or environmental policy. And sometimes it's, like you said, someone's personhood is somehow up for debate. And it's very real, it's very specific, and it's like a person in your life whose interests you want to protect and support and love. And so that's worth standing up for. But again, it's a question of when is the right forum for it? And is it in the large group conversation right around that moment of bonding of sharing the first course or the second course of the meal? Or is it, you know, alongside around the edges of that where you can talk to somebody one-on-one and say, you know, look, when I heard you say this, it made me think about my friend and I'm watching what they're struggling with, and I think it would be really hurtful if they heard that, and it hurts me to hear that, and I just want you to know that that's how that occurs to me, and I think that's a totally fair thing to do. You're not dressing them down in front of everybody else. You're inviting them to respond, but you're also really letting them know, the impact that our words and our actions and our comments have.
So, Jason, what happens if the other person then becomes defensive? How do you handle that?
With love. I mean, I think, you know, it's important to understand if we want someone to change, it's important. You always have to understand, what is it that you're asking them to lose? What is it that you're asking them to give up? People are motivated by what they're worried about losing. And that might be a certain stature. It might be a certain sense of themselves as a moral person or being part of a moral community, how they have learned to define that. And recognize that there is when someone becomes defensive, it's because there's something that they care about that is under threat, and they're aiming to protect it. And so recognizing that that is going to be part of a process, but trying to stay loving through all of that is the real game here.
And perhaps suggest having a conversation down the road over lunch, maybe talking a little bit more about it so that you kind of diffuse tensions at the table?
Yep. Okay. I totally agree.
All right, we've got some more. Oh, go ahead, Jason.
No, go ahead.
We've got some more emails and tweets coming in. Bill says, all was great at Thanksgiving last year until the second hour when politics came up. After that, mm-hmm. the food was forgotten and blood pressures rose. And mm-hmm. then we've got another follow-up tweet from Amanda who says, I have these conversations all the time as part of my job, but my dad is 87, my uncle is 90, and it's not worth it. So mm-hmm. are there other things that we need to take into consideration as we deal with different groups from different generations of all ages and perhaps different outlooks on life?
Yeah. You know, it's a great question. I remember when my grandmother was in her 90s and, I made it a regular habit to call her, on a once a month basis. And, in those conversations, we somehow I would always be calling her when she was in the middle of either Rush Limbaugh or Fox News. Mm-hmm. Sometimes she would vent about things that were going on in her community that, and I would, she had a church where the church was lending the space to a group of Mexican immigrants who were conducting services in Spanish. And she wasn't comfortable with that. She felt like it was, somehow that was treading on her territory. And I was confronted with exactly that question that person just tweeted about is like, do I confront a racist sort of perspective in the part of somebody who's in their 90s.
Well, what did you do?
I let it slide. I sort of let it slide. What I said was, Grandma, they just came to this country. They don't have a place to worship. It's probably the Christian thing to do to let them use the space. And she said, yeah, maybe it's the Christian thing to do. I don't know. And I didn't push it any further. I didn't bring it up again later. I don't think I changed her mind about it. But, it was, I think she passed away maybe a year or two after that. Mm-hmm. And I still called her, every month to kind of keep that connection alive. Yeah. In part because it's important to me to have that relationship with the previous generations and with people who are in other parts of the country and, a lot of reasons why that relationship mattered to me. So, there are no right answers here. And it's funny because, you write a book on something and everyone assumes you're the expert. I've done like TEDx talks on this and stuff, but I've been, even recently in family conversations around the Rosh Hashanah dinner table that got pretty heated. Mm-hmm. There is no such thing as sort of perfect mastery of how to handle these situations. Everyone is specific. Every one of these relationships is specific. All I know is that, some degree of preparation and some degree of mindfulness in the moment and just being deliberate about where and when you raise these questions is really important.
I was hearing other words, vulnerability earlier in the conversation, a sense of humility, and perhaps also coming into a room, even though we really, really disagree with somebody on a particularly divisive topic, not necessarily feeling we have to leave the room having convinced them of our perspective.
I think convincing, changing another person's mind is a very rare occurrence. And the actions we take in order to produce that result are often counterproductive. I think that the kind of outcomes we should be going for are helping, are basically about learning. Going in with curiosity to understand another person's perspective and how they came to their point of view and what is it about their life experience that has them taking a stand that may seem ridiculous and unintelligible to us. But if we really can see it from their point of view, you know, we can start to see how it works. And conversely, to be heard and to have someone else see, even if they don't agree with your perspective, how you came to it. Because just achieving that basic degree of respect as two people who can see their differences but see them as see each other as people, that would be progress in their current political culture. Mm-hmm. A sort of level two is to say, okay, look, you know, you value, you know, freedom, and I value justice. You know, how do we sort of try to have both at the same time? I remember a conversation after the financial crisis with a friend who worked in Wall Street, and we were talking about financial regulation. And, you know, we started out kind of arguing about our different sort of favorite policies for dealing with the financial crisis. And I was saying, you know, more regulation, more consumer protection, you know, the typical liberal sort of points of view. Yeah. And, you know, he was saying, well, you know, but I just don't think the government is going to be able to regulate all this stuff. It's really complicated. And we don't, you know, I think you need to have more faith in the American people that they can make their own decisions about their finances. And what happened in that conversation, we started listening for, okay, you want to trust people to make their individual choices, and you want to give them the freedom to do that. And I want people to be protected from being exploited by, you know, big banks. And so
we only have 10 seconds left. I'm so sorry.
So then you can start to explore ways that you could achieve both of those goals at the same time. Okay. And then trying to come up with things that achieve both sets of values at the same time, that's a real win, not changing the other person's mind.
All right. This conversation continues in just a moment. Also, we're going to ask, what if someone says something really offensive, like a racist remark or slur? How do we handle that? Stay with us. That conversation is coming up. Welcome back to Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. We've been talking about dealing with conversational landmines at gatherings of family and friends with Jason Jay, who is co-author of Breaking Through Gridlock, The Power of Conversation in a Polarized World. What happens if someone makes a racist remark? Do we confront that person, try to talk it out, let it slide in an effort to avoid a confrontation? How do we best handle this conversation? Jason Jay is with us for the rest of the hour. Joining us now, journalist Rachel Swarns covers race relations as a contributing writer for The New York Times. Welcome to Radio Times, Rachel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. So you recently talked about race and racist remarks in a live New York Times video chat. Let's begin by characterizing the racist remarks. Sometimes it's just obvious. Sometimes, depending on your background or race, it might not be, at least to one of the parties involved. Could you get into that for us?
You know, this is a tough thing sometimes, and particularly as, you know, we're heading into holidays and we'll all be sitting around the table with folks whom we may or may not agree about different things, politics, and sometimes these racial issues come up. Sometimes it's really clear. It's a racial slur. It's something that is clearly to everyone offensive. Sometimes it's just not. One of the things that often comes up is, and many people of color talk about this, and I'm African American, I've experienced this too. It's the kind of comment which is meant to be a nice comment, but really isn't. Like, so you might hear someone praise a person of color for how they speak. Oh, you're so articulate, which, again, is coming from a nice place. But behind that is most Black people aren't, or I haven't encountered many who are. Mm-hmm. And so we, at the New York Times, when I decide to have this conversation, we sometimes get letters from people saying, hey, you know, I've got this friend, I've got this coworker, these comments come up. What should I do? And, you know, these questions come from people, you know, across, you know, the racial and ethnic spectrum. We're all struggling, I think, a bit right now.
So as a woman of color, when you hear a remark like that, what does it do to you?
It makes me so tired. I think that's the first thing. Mm-hmm. It makes me really tired. And many people, myself included, you know, sometimes you just don't know what to say. And you think to yourself, goodness, is it worth it? Is it not? Is it? And a lot of that depends on who is saying it.
So get into that a little bit more. But who is saying it? What does that mean?
So, you know, because, you know, our relationships mean something to us. And it would be nice to think that, you know, the racist remark, you know, only comes from, you know, that person you happen to bump into, you know, on the sidewalk or in the subway or, you know, in the grocery store, some stranger who you could say, oh, my gosh, that's awful what you just said, or, you know. Yeah. But sometimes it's from coworkers or a boss maybe or your cousin or your grandmother. And I think those conversations are obviously going to be different conversations.
Jason Jay, would you like to chime in? How do you think that should be handled?
I mean, I have to totally defer to Rachel on this. I think it's as a you know, straight cis white man, I think I've got huge blind spots around all these issues, and I certainly, you know, resonate with what you said about the sort of seemingly benign comment that is actually, you know,
insulting.
Insulting, right? Yeah. It betrays this, and I've confronted that with people in my family, where I've heard them describe a black politician or leader as articulate. It's so common, and I've raised that as an issue with family members who just didn't. It wasn't on their radar to be conscious of that, and what that again reveals, like you said, is there's an implicit expectation that you're not going to be. I see that a lot.
One thing that I found is, you know, for that one in particular, my father has a great comeback for that, which is when people say, oh, my goodness, you're so articulate, he says, you know, you too. Where did you learn? And it's one of those things where it just makes the person think, well, that's ridiculous, and then makes them think, oh, my goodness, maybe what I said was kind of ridiculous, you know?
Mm-hmm. And a little humor, too, doesn't hurt, right?
That's really great.
Exactly right. And the same thing with the, you know, folks, Asian Americans, Latinos, often get the, you know, where are you from?
Yeah.
Where are you from, really? You know, when you say, oh, Brooklyn, you know, where are you from? No, but where are you really from? And again, flipping that around and say, oh, but where are you from? No, really, where are you from? Again, is another way to kind of just raise consciousness. But I think the other thing to think about for, you know, the family member who, you know, might bring up something at the Thanksgiving dinner table is to, and it seems so crazy, but to prepare a bit for it. I think that, you know, Jason was talking about not changing minds. I think that's right. You're not going to change minds, but you might make someone think a bit. So if you've got a cousin who is often saying offensive things about immigrants, for instance, and you know, saying, oh, they're, you know, taking everything and they're always on, you know, welfare, et cetera, you might, you know, just if you want to put your toe in the water, you might just do a little research and find out what the numbers are and say, oh, you know, it's so funny, I just happened to be reading, and, you know, the statistics on whites receiving welfare, you'd be surprised at what they are. Do you know what they are?
Preparation is key.
Sometimes facts, again, it's not going to, because sometimes these attitudes actually aren't really factually based. So, but sometimes facts might surprise someone. You know, do you know what the number, you know?
Right. And we only have a minute or so left with you, Rachel, and I wanted to get to the tougher conversation or a tougher piece of the conversation. You received one note that said, you know, the N-word is racist, whoever says it. A complicated statement. How do we navigate that? And do whites and blacks view this? Well, whites and blacks many view this differently?
I think people need to know that African Americans, on the whole, feel like the N-word, even though, you know, it's commonly used and you'll hear it in music and you'll hear sometimes black people use it amongst each other. It is a no-go, where it is extremely offensive when used by whites. I think it's really important, or anyone, it's really important for people to know that. And it's a longer conversation probably than we have time for, but just knowing that, steer clear, I would strongly suggest.
Just don't go there. So again, just to recap, if you encounter a racist remark at a holiday gathering, just a quick tip, immediately you do what, Rachel?
There isn't a quick tip. I wish there was a quick tip. There isn't one.
Don't go in hot.
Like I said, if you know it's coming, you can prepare for it. Mm-hmm. And like I said, sometimes I think facts are more helpful than other things. But you could also just say, you know, that makes me feel uncomfortable, and you know, it's offensive to me and to a lot of people, and I'd rather not go there. You know, I think sometimes I don't know. Engaging in arguments about it usually is not productive. And your grandmother or your cousin probably, you know, they're probably not going to change. But that's why sometimes I think facts are useful, because then let them struggle with those facts. Let them wrestle with that if they want to. And if you want to dive in there. And the other thing is just to say that it's personally offensive to me. Yeah.
And don't sweep it under the rug.
You know, I wish I could say I never sweep it under the rug. Sometimes you do. Sometimes you take a deep breath and you leave the room, you know.
Jason, you're trying to get a word in edgewise there.
Yeah.
No, sorry. I was just going to say, I was going to try something. You know, there is a sequence that I found very useful, which is, you know, when I hear you say this thing, I think, you know, wow, that comment really is, you know, offensive. And I have a feeling, which is, it makes me feel angry. It makes me feel sad. And what I want is for us to not use that language, or to question our assumptions. So it's when I see, I think, I feel, I want. And so it all is sort of, it's not saying you are, that's a racist comment, you are a racist. It's saying, it's taking responsibility for, these are the things that causes me to think and feel. And then therefore you can be more aware in the future of the things that you're causing people to think and feel around you. And maybe that is a bridge to that kind of awareness that that Rachel mentioned.
Rachel, that narrative, what do you think?
I think I agree with that, because I think, like I said, I think sometimes these attitudes are not easily movable. But if you're at the Thanksgiving dinner table, you're probably with people who care about you and who might, maybe might not too, but might respond to that, to say that, you know, that's really offensive to me. And, you know, I love you. And I just would like to have a nice dinner. So it's offensive to me, and it's offensive to a lot of other people. I think let's talk about something else. And then you're laying it out there that's really out of bounds. But we're together. Let's try and move past it. I got to say, I don't know whether it will work, but it's worth trying.
Rachel, do you have the time to stay with us through the top of the hour?
I sure do.
Okay, let's get to the phones. Anne in Montgomery County joins us now. Welcome, Anne, to Radio Times.
Hello, I'm calling because I think these conversations have been taking place for a long time over many struggles in this country. And I just read an account from a Quaker relative in Montgomery County who was an abolitionist. His name is Charles Kirk. And he recounts being at a dinner table with a neighbor, and the neighbor had slaves in Montgomery County. And I don't know if this was pre-planned on their part or if it was spontaneous, but Charles Kirk and his wife decided they could not eat any of the food at the table because it was prepared by, it was generated from slave labor. And it generated an amazing conversation. He was also banned from being an elder in the Quaker meeting because he was an abolitionist. But I think that the dinner table is where we show up. And I just thought I'd offer that, that this has been going on, and I kind of feel the ancestors talking.
We appreciate that call to Radio Times, Anne. And again, it raises the question, when do you take a stand? Jason?
It's really up to each individual person and the context. And, you know, is the... what does it mean for you to take a stand? What does it mean for you? What does it mean to you to take a stand? What will it achieve for you? Will it help you be heard among people whom you want to be heard? Will it help to raise awareness among people whose awareness you care about? Will it help to create inclusion of people in that you want to be included? Will it raise attention on issues that you care about and that you want to see people paying attention to, environmental, social, economic, whatever. If those things are really important to you, then it's worth doing. But it's worth doing right. It's worth doing with intentionality and with mindfulness and with love.
So, Rachel, when do you think it's time to cross the conversational line?
You know, it's an interesting thing. And I do think that... it is important, and again, if it's a loved one, you got to think about how you do it. But I think it is important I think it's important to say something. I think that there is a sense sometimes among people that, and this could be among, you know, various ethnic groups, that, you know, oh, I can say this homophobic remark right here. These folks know me, and it's okay. I think we kind of need to start letting people know it's not okay. And I think by being silent, and I have been silent sometimes when I've had, remarks, people say remarks that were offensive to me just because I was kind of stunned speechless. But I think we have to kind of say something and figure that out, because in a way we're encouraging the conversations, those conversations to continue. Not that you're going to change someone's mind, because I don't think you will, but you might make people think a little bit.
Yeah. Well, here's an interesting note to perhaps end the show with. We've got a tweet that says, I found it important to limit adult beverages and to, again, back up your opinions. It's like there might be something there. But one more question. A question from Julia. How do you deal with hurtful, sarcastic remarks when they're aimed at you? And so just quickly, Jason, let's go to you.
So in the same way that you can get clear about your intentions, I think you can ask someone what their intentions are. This is something that my wife does all the time. She'll say, you know, what are you really trying to accomplish with that comment? What are you hoping to do by saying that to me? And I think it is a somewhat confrontational response, but it's also asking the person to own up to, are they trying to be hurtful? Are they trying to score points? Are they trying to do something? And then invite them into a level of consciousness and intentionality of like, okay, I guess the point I was trying to make is this, and then make it in a more deliberate, straightforward way.
All right, we've got to stop you there. We are unfortunately out of time. Jason Jay, so good to have you along with us today.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Thank you, and happy Thanksgiving. Jason Jay is co-author of Breaking Through Gridlock, The Power of Conversation in a Polarized World. I'm sorry for stepping all over you there. And Rachel Swarns is a journalist and author who covers race and race relations as a contributing writer for The New York Times. Thanks, Rachel.
Thanks for having me.
Our engineer today has been Diana Martinez. Our producers, Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Alex Stern. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan. Thanks so much for joining us for Radio Times.